One, hold the paper up. One, two, three.
You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeter. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeter.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeter.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Wednesday, December 4th, 2013. My name is Sam Steeter. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, following the ruling by a federal judge that pensions in Detroit for Detroit city workers can be cut in their bankruptcy proceedings, Chris Savage of Eclectablog will be joining us. Also on the program today, not only did the Pope make Jesus weep, but WorldNet Daily is convinced it's a KGB plot. And the platinum coin, you all remember the platinum coin, right? The ridiculous notion that the Treasury could mint a platinum coin to deal with the Republicans' refusal to raise the debt ceiling. It turns out the Obama administration was seriously considering it. Healthcare.gov seems to be working fairly well. Seen a surge of 1 million people having visited the site over the past 36 hours. More on the minimum wage and those third-way attacks on populist Democrats, brought to you by corporate America and the right wing. Also, Scott Walker has an interesting notion of what you should do with your to celebrate the holidays. Chris Christie flip-flops. Yes, careful. Stand back. It does a big flip-flop on immigration legislation in New Jersey. The war on Christmas continues, folks. We will give you an update from the battle lines. New revelations as to what The Guardian has been going through since it started reporting on the NSA. Before we get to Chris Savage, it's been now, I guess, a couple of months of hand-wringing about the Affordable Care Act and whether or not the website would be up to the task of enrolling people, and it seems that the worm has turned. I mean, to the extent that the worm can turn, healthcare.gov signed up 29,000 people on Sunday and Monday, which is more than everyone who enrolled through healthcare.gov in October. There has been 1 million visitors, like I said, for 2 days straight now. And the site has held up. I mean, I think over the past weeks, we have not been covering the day-to-day machinations of this because, frankly, I think my sense has been that in 2 months from now, 3 months from now, I think I was saying a month ago, by the end of the first quarter, this is not going to be a story anymore. And in fact, the story is going to change. because more and more people are going to start getting health insurance. They're going to find that it's cheaper, if not better, for them. And still, we're still talking about not an insignificant number of people, but a very, very small percentage of people who are impacted by, well, the healthcare.gov portion of the Affordable Care Act. There are millions of people who have gotten health insurance because of the expansion of Medicaid. There are millions of people who have been denied health insurance because their Republican governor has refused to accept the expansion of Medicaid. That is going to be more of the story by the time we get to springtime. I can assure you. There's going to be a lot of things to talk about from a policy level, what is working, what is not working on a policy level, what improvements we have seen, what improvements we still need. We're going to be talking in the coming months and weeks, frankly, about what's happening in Vermont as they push for a single-payer healthcare system. That we're going to talk about the chances of seeing something like that in Massachusetts. Donald Berwick, a guy who I think we have talked about in the context of his failure to be confirmed to sit on a Medicare and Medicaid advisory board, who is running for governor of Massachusetts. But from a political standpoint, one of the things that I've avoided is all the hand-wringing over the past month and a half, because I just think that this is a brief moment in time. And while this is a public-private partnership, this is essentially to prop up the insurance industries that had a failed business model. The hand-wringing, it was tied to a broader liberal agenda of government being able to do things effectively to help people. That battle, I think, it was prematurely declared over, and the notion that government can do things, I think, was prematurely deigned to have failed. It's obviously not the case if a million people are visiting the site. We're talking only about, in terms of the private insurance industry, the non-group insurance policies. We're not talking tens of millions of people. We're talking maybe 15 million people, and not all of them have been affected by this. So the notion that a million people have visited that site is, I think, indicative of what people think that they can get from government. Rightly so. So we'll talk more about this. In a week or two, I'm going down to that Families USA conference that I go to every year, and it'll be full of healthcare wonks. We will talk about that more then. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Chris Savage of Eclectablog. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program Chris Savage. He is the proprietor of Eclectablog, which covers Michigan politics about as well as any blog out there. Chris, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Sam. I appreciate it. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
So, all right, let's start. I want to, you know, there's a couple of things that I want to talk to you about, but let's sort of work backwards, shall we? Yesterday, there was a ruling by a federal court judge who is handling the Chapter 9 bankruptcy filing for Detroit. Tell us about that, the key parts of his rulings yesterday.
Right. So basically what happened was after Detroit became under the control of an emergency manager, that emergency manager, Kevin Orr, filed bankruptcy papers. They had to go through a hearing or a process with Judge Rhodes, the federal bankruptcy judge, to ensure that they were actually qualified to be eligible for bankruptcy, which he yesterday determined that they were. He also made a couple other determinations. One is that Michigan's emergency manager law, which actually was turned down or repealed by voters last year in November, and then returned several weeks later by the Republicans that are in the majority in Lansing, that was a legal law. And he said that it was, despite the fact that Michigan voters had overturned it. And then third, he also said that the pensions of retired Detroit public employees are on the table to be cut as part of how they would resolve the financial crisis in Detroit. So there was three pretty major decisions that were made yesterday.
Let's take the last one first. Now, this is essentially the third one that, despite the fact that the Michigan State Constitution says that such pensions are binding and contractual and cannot be reversed, the essentially the Supremacy Clause of the United States Constitution allows for federal bankruptcy laws, I guess, to supersede this. Is that essentially right?
Yeah, that's right. He basically said that the federal law trumps the state law. So even though these pensions are protected by our state constitution, he said that that is overruled basically by federal law.
Now, give me your sense. I mean, this was obviously this was the long range plan that the Republicans in Lansing, as you call them, and Governor Snyder had, right? I mean, this is
it sure seems like it. When you hire an emergency manager who works for a law firm that specializes in municipal bankruptcies and is himself a bankruptcy attorney, it seems pretty clear that that was the end game here. And the part about this, because when they first started talking about bankruptcy in Detroit, I was actually in support of that, because if you read the Chapter 9 bankruptcy rules, there are two elements of that that are really crucial. One is that it protects local democracy. It keeps locally elected officials in place. And it also protects city-owned assets or municipal-owned assets from being basically looted. And to me, that was an improvement over the imposition of an emergency manager, where all that stuff goes off the table. But what they've done in Michigan is to sort of do an end run around that, in that they've replaced the local government with an emergency manager and then filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, so that although they need the permission of the local government to do things like dispense of assets, now the local government is one person. It's a Kevin Orr. So they sort of got their cake and eat it, too, if you want to put it that way. They've got the ability now to do pretty much what they want, unfortunately. So that's the tragic part about it.
I want to talk a little bit more about the emergency manager law, because I'm not sure that people are totally familiar with this, although it's been in the news for quite some time. But
sure.
I mean, give me a sense of were there any arguments made by, I mean, And in this instance, I mean, I'm curious as to, like, who are the two parties that are going in there? In other words, you know, if the city at this point is represented by the emergency manager, who is arguing for the argument that at the very least the sequencing of this was wrong? That you have skirted the intent of the Chapter 9 bankruptcy laws.
You know, I don't think a lot of people are talking about that. That's the part that's been a little frustrating to me. I've been talking about it on my blog for quite a while, but nobody really talks about the fact that the protections that are in Chapter 9, the Chapter 9 rules, are really bypassed by the fact that the local government now basically is represented by one person, who was an unelected official appointed by Governor Snyder. So I mean, there are plenty of labor groups and others that are sort of trying to protect the protect the benefit packages, for example, of the retirees who are, you know, out there fighting for it, Ask Me and people like that. And ironically, our state attorney general, Bill Schuette, who is one of the largest Tea Party Republicans you'll find in our state government is actually on the record as supporting the protection of those constitutionally protected pension benefits. But outside of that, you know, you've got this one guy who nobody trusts, and then you've got the labor unions who are sort of holding down the fort as far as protecting the retirees. And you have to keep in mind that we're only talking about 21,000 people, I think, something like that, and their average pension is like $19,000. And a lot of these people gave up Social Security in lieu of these pensions. So they have not been paying into Social Security. They've rather been paying into this pension process as their retirement. And now that they are in their retirement and have no other way to bring in income, now they're looking at maybe facing cuts to that. And most of these people are living check to check, frankly.
That is stunning. And I think that's a point that I think most people don't realize is that as a city worker, the pension often supplants Social Security.
That's right. Absolutely.
And so wait, so I'm still unclear as to who, I mean, who are the parties that come before this judge? And you know, like, who is do the unions as a creditor, I guess, of the city, do they get to go in front of the judge at that point? I mean, who's making these arguments?
On behalf of the pension people?
Yeah.
Primarily it's Ask Me. Who's doing most of that they're the ones who sent attorneys to participate in this hearing that's been going on over the past few months or few weeks anyway. So they are the ones who are responsible for protecting the retirees primarily.
And so the judge simply said that these are on the table. They aren't necessarily going to be cut.
That's right. And, you know, he was pretty firm about that, that although it's on the table, he's not committing to doing that. And I will say that Judge Rhodes has been, at least in his rhetoric, very sympathetic, shall I say, to the retirees and understands that these people did not cause this problem. There are, you know, representatives of the pension investment board and stuff that probably are culpable, but the pensioners themselves, they didn't cause this problem. And Detroit's financial crisis has been, you know, years and years in the making, and there's a lot of complexity to that. That, you know, at the end of the day, you can't blame these retired, you know, trash collectors and firefighters and police officers and office workers. These people didn't cause this problem, and to put them on the hook to solve this problem is ridiculous. Meanwhile, Kevin Orr, the emergency manager, is working out a deal where he's going to borrow money from Barclays Bank to pay off some pension swaps that happened under Kwame Kilpatrick, who is now sitting in prison, and has Detroit really strung out in some serious debt. And he's going to borrow money to pay them back, which does eventually save the city some money. But what it does is it pays off the banks basically in full, and then the retirees get to fight over, you know, what's left with all the other big banks that are on the hook. So this, you know, he's basically found a way to move the banks to the front of the line so that they get paid off in full while the retirees face cuts.
And
that's to me outrageous.
And my understanding is that one of the mechanisms to sort of trigger these payments is also a question of how the Detroit's municipal bonds are rated. And in the event that there's a drop in their rating, the banks not only move to the head of the line, but basically get their interest payments immediately.
That's right.
And yeah, could you walk us through that, please?
Well, I'm not an attorney, so I'm not going to be able to give you specifics on that. But basically, what they did was this was back when Kwame Kilpatrick was the mayor. They consolidated a lot of debt and did put it in, and then they basically put it into credit default swaps, which again, I'm not an expert on, but they did put in a clause there, as you say, that would require the city to pay its interest, you know, the interest that they figured it would accrue in the future immediately to protect the banks from, you know, losing out on this. And one of the things that Kevin Orr has done that's unusual is to put all of the creditors, including the bondholders, on an equal footing and not put the banks to the beginning or to, you know, at the front of the line, although he's found a way to do that in a different way. You know, these were really poorly negotiated, instruments that probably looked pretty good at the time to, you know, the people that were in charge of Detroit. But it also, you know, it really resembles to me the sort of predatory lending that happens
right
in places like Detroit to, you know, screw people out of their homes, basically, to give people you know, mortgages that had no business getting mortgages because they could never afford it. And Detroit was that way. And I see the banks as sort of looking at Detroit as a cash cow where they could come in there, lend away to a city that was already beginning to circle the drain, and then, you know, with the understanding, at least on their own part, that they would just walk away completely free and that they would be at the front of the line to collect full while everybody else sort of dealt with the aftermath.
And certainly the story of the bankers coming in and selling defective products to pensions is not one that's unique to Detroit. I mean, we've seen this in states across the country. We've seen this in terms of municipalities. We've seen it in terms of large institutions, public institutions like schools, universities. I mean, so this is, in that respect, this story is not unique, except for the fact that Detroit is in a crisis stage, and it is the impact of it is that much more, I guess, devastating. Let's talk about the aspect of the city assets, because it was a story that there. I'm aware that the one of the plans is to sell off the assets from the Detroit Museum. Tell us about that.
Right. So the Detroit Institute of Arts has a really a world class collection of art, some of which has been donated, some of which has been purchased. And, you know, 3 months ago or something like that, Kevin Orr brought in Christie's Auction House to basically do a reckoning and figure out how much it's all worth. And with the potential of selling some of that art or monetizing it in some way as a way to pay down the debt. And so there's obviously a lot of outrage. And in some respects, it's the first real pain that rich people in southeastern Michigan have felt with regard to the bankruptcy in terms of it affecting them directly. And it's created quite an outrage. And, you know, and not only has Detroit, you know, basically paid Barclays several million dollars to come in and do this assessment, but now the creditors have asked for an independent group, and they've asked the city to pay for this to come in and do their own assessment, because they're not certain that Christie's is going to be you know, fair about this. So you know, there's a lot of outrage that, you know, a collection of art that's world class, that is held in trust on behalf of the people of Michigan, might potentially be sold you know, to pay down debt that they had nothing to do with. And I should say that the DIA is it's self-funded. It's funded through local municipalities, not just Detroit. So it's not just a Detroit museum. It's actually a regional museum, and they don't cost the city anything. But they've been asked to cough up as much as $500 million, or, you know, Kevin Orr coming into a forum, basically.
And give me a sense of what your sense was as to the bankruptcy judge's disposition in that regard.
Well, one thing that he said that I really appreciated was that, you know, quick fixes like that, a quick influx, one-time influx of money is not going to solve Detroit's problems. And one of the things that I've been saying all along is that emergency managers don't come to the table with any tools to build and construct. They come with tools to cut and destruct. And so they can come in and they can cut budgets, they can fire people, they can eliminate contracts, things like that. They have no way of sort of fortifying the city in a way that propels them into the future in a way that will sustain them. And that was recognized by Judge Rhodes in his comments yesterday, and I was very appreciative of that, because it's really like eating your seed corn to do something like that. Detroit Institute of Arts is a major draw for that area, and it actually brings revenues into the city. It brings way more revenues into the city than it costs, because it costs nothing. I mean, it literally doesn't cost the city of Detroit anything to have that museum there, but it brings people in to spend money in Detroit. You know, if you go to where the Detroit Museum Institute of Art is, there's an area around there that's actually doing fairly well relative to a lot of other parts of Detroit. So it's sort of a hub of development and prosperity that you don't see in other places. So I just see it as such a short-sighted way to try to garner a quick fix influx of money into the city.
Give us a breakdown of how you feel that Detroit got into this situation. I mean, obviously, this has been a years in the making catastrophe in some respects. But just give us sort of the broad outlines. I mean, there's definitely I definitely have a sense that Governor Snyder sort of saw Detroit teetering and gave it a little bit of a push by cutting state funds. But give us a sense of how we got up to that point, and then what Snyder did.
Well, I mean, the thing about Detroit that is at its base true is that it's a very complex situation as to where it got to where it is today. And I get very frustrated at people, particularly from the outside of Detroit, trying to pin Detroit's crisis on one thing, you know, Democratic leadership or the unions or, you know, whatever you want to call it, pensions, for example. It's very complicated. I mean, at the end of the day, you can't ignore the fact that the implosion of the manufacturing sector in Detroit was probably the first key thing that really, you know, devastated the city. The city's lost a tremendous amount of population. It's down from millions of residents down to 700,000. So it's got a smaller pool of people paying taxes and generating revenue for the city, but supporting an infrastructure that was for, you know, a much, much larger city. And the legacy costs that come from, you know, existing as a city that's that large for so long.
And we should also say that it's a sprawling city. I mean, the city physically is quite large, and so you've got infrastructure costs that are that much greater than a very densely packed city. And then, as you say, to lose several times over your population is that much more devastating.
Absolutely right. And certainly on top of that, we've had corruption in Detroit. There's no question about that. I mean, you can go back several different administrations, and there's been poor decisions made, and in some cases, actual corruption that's taken place that's really hamstrung the city. The demise of the automotive industry in Detroit was really what set Detroit on its course. And they've been in sort of panic, you know, control mode ever since then, trying to figure out a way out of their financial mess. And they've made some really terrible, terrible decisions. And you know, some of the debt that was taken on during the Kilpatrick administration is really, at the core of what, you know, Detroit is facing right now. But, you know, one of the things you have to realize is that Kevin Orr works for a company called Jones Day. And Jones Day had a couple of staff people that wrote a white paper a few years ago called Pensions in Chapter 9, Can Municipalities Use Bankruptcy to Solve Their Pension Woes? You know, so this is a company, they're a law firm that is looking at Chapter 9 as a way to have cities get out from underneath their pension obligations. And that, to me, is just the most heartbreaking part about this. When you look at, you know, when they do interviews with the people that are receiving these pensions, and, you know, you realize these people aren't living high on the hog. These are people that are, you know, in many cases, you know, unable, they couldn't work if they wanted to, because not only are they elderly, but in some cases they're sick or whatever. I mean, and they're out living on a very meager budget. So, you know, that to me just, you know, I want to believe the best in Kevin Orr, because he's a Democrat, and, you know, I he says all the right things. But then when you look at the bigger picture, you know, and in the company that he worked for, it's really hard to see this as anything but a way to use bankruptcy to help the banks out, basically. And it's also worth noting that his company that he used to work for, literally he quit to come and be the emergency manager, has already received $11 million from the city as a consultant, and they stand to make another $7 million before this thing's over with. In the meantime, the state of Michigan has capped their support for Michigan in payments and all this stuff to $5 million. And this is after cutting like $43 million annually of revenue sharing from the city of Detroit.
Yes, and that was my point, I think, in terms of like pushing Detroit over the edge.
Absolutely. And it's, you know, they've done this all over the state in terms of emergency managers, where they cut, you know, billions of dollars out of our schools budget, for example. And now we've got something like 10% of our schools operating in deficits and being taken over by emergency managers. So they create this financial crisis. And then they use that crisis as a way to come in and take over at the state level. And what that often means is privatizing of services to for-profit industries. It means selling off of assets. And, you know, Michigan leads the country in terms of for-profit charter schools. And, you know, this whole emergency manager process just helps that along, because it seems like a quick fix. Oh, we'll just bring in business and they'll take care of this. But when you start offering services to, you know, and providing those services by for-profit corporations, then instead of maximizing the services, you are maximizing the bottom line, because it's a profit-taking situation.
All right. Well, you know, and I want to turn to the schools because I think, you know, the the thing that I think that, that people need to be clear about with what's happening is with Detroit, and I think the fact that Kevin Orr's former law firm, which I'm sure he will at one point return to, this is a neoliberal model for what they hope will happen in other municipalities across the country. I mean, once you can set this precedent that we can cut the pensions of people who are making $19,000 a year, and basically to the benefit of the bankers who are not going to take any haircut in this type of bankruptcy, you have set that precedent. This becomes a model. And that's why I think what is happening in Detroit, what is happening in Michigan is so important for people to understand and fight back against and also be aware of. And let's talk about that greater project of privatization, because like you say, Michigan does have, I think, an extraordinary amount of charter schools relative to even to the rest of the country. And it is undercutting. I mean, this is for those people who want to see what's wrong with the concept of charter schools. And I happen to be someone who believes that there is some value in charter schools in certain specific instances and in terms of what they were meant to do originally, which was to generate ideas that could be borrowed and scaled up for public education. I think we've lost sight of what charter schools were supposed to do. But what it's functioning to do in Michigan, and I would argue in other places, but clearly I think this is really, the story is really clear in Michigan, it is starving the public schools of resources.
Let me give you a good example of this. Near where I live, just outside Ann Arbor, but just to the east of there is where two school districts, Will Run and Ypsilanti, that would have been in deficit for a long, long time. And they had finally started to get their financial house in order. This is roughly 2010, 2011. And right about as soon as the Snyder administration came in and the sort of Republican Tea Party wave were elected in 2010, they cut the budget in Michigan for schools by like $1 billion. And so right as these two school districts were finally starting to see the light at the end of the tunnel of their financial crisis, they had a huge chunk of their money taken out of their budgets. And it was like a guy crawling out of a hole and having his fingers on the edge and somebody come along and stomping on his fingers and kicking him back down into the hole. And, you know, and then the next stop for them was to get an emergency manager. Well, they have fortunately avoided that by combining the school districts, but they have had to just go under incredible austerity measures to do this. Meanwhile, right across the street, literally right across the street from one of the schools, they're setting up a charter school. And this is a school that will now compete for those same students. And in Michigan, we pay our schools by the number of students that they have. And if you take 100 students out, you just took out several hundred thousand dollars out of their budget every year. So, you know, they're literally setting up charter schools that are in competition and starving the local public schools in the process. And it really is a way to destroy public schools. And in the process, you know, the teachers' unions and things like that, which have been demonized as being responsible for all of the school funding problems.
And you have a tremendous amount of your charter schools are for-profit charter schools as well.
Yeah, we lead the way in that regard. I think something like 80% of our schools, charter schools, are for-profit, and I think we have something like 50% of the for-profit charter schools in the country here. So it's, you know, we're definitely, you know, you said something earlier that I've been trying to say now for like 3 years since the Snyder administration came in, and that's that, yeah, what's going on in Michigan is horrible and egregious and outrageous, and we should all be offended by that. But it's also a bellwether for what could happen across the country. And so everybody should be paying attention to what's going on here and raising the klaxons in warning about this, because, it, you know, what's happening in Michigan could very well come to a school district or a municipality near you.
And in fact, I think it was just earlier this month, you had a downgrade of the bond ratings of 50 some odd schools in Michigan. Is that right?
That's right. You know, we're in dire straits here. And yet our governor, who's running for office next year, is calling us the comeback state. And we're literally like the second or third highest unemployment rate in the entire country. And it's been stagnant for 3 months, and the 2 months before that it went up. So it's, you know, for all of their rhetoric, you know, Michigan is not flourishing under a Republican regime that made it, you know, the birthplace of labor, a right-to-work state.
Tell us just a little bit about the EAA, the Michigan's Education Achievement Authority. I've read a little bit about this, but I'm not terribly familiar with it.
Now, the Education Achievement Authority is a state-run school district that represents something like 5% of the worst-performing schools in the state. So they basically took these schools and put them into one school district to be managed by a chancellor. They literally call them a chancellor. And they're going to, you know, revitalize these school districts. Unfortunately, what they have found is that they're not performing. The kids that are in these schools are not achieving at rates that you would expect them to. And they're also very likely in violation of federal and state laws regarding the education of kids who are handicapped and things like that, that, you know, that would fall under the Americans with Disabilities Act. And we've got a couple of really fierce warriors, Democrats in our state House and Senate who have been really championing this cause. Ellen Kogan Lipton is one of them, and Senator Hopgood. And they have gone to the EA and say, look, you know, you tell us that you're doing this thing, you know, that you're doing this amazing thing here. We'd like to see the data, and we'd like to understand that. And they've literally been forced to file FOIA requests to get the information. And these are state legislators. They have had to file FOIA requests and pay for it out of their own pocket because the EAA won't give them the information that they want. Meanwhile, the Republicans are trying to expand the EAA and codify it into our state law. So it's been a big deal. And, you know, the evidence is mounting that this school district is not performing and that it's actually harming, you know, certain segments of the school population. So, you know, there's a lot of hue and cry, and there was a big protest yesterday at Eastern Michigan University, which has partnered with the EAA, because a lot of the faculty members there are in the education college there are just, you know, very unhappy with their university's involvement with the EAA.
Interesting.
So that's a story that remains to be told, but it's, you know, there's a lot of stuff that happens sort of behind the scenes, and we're told that we should just trust them and everything's fine, and yet they won't produce the evidence to support that. You know, they've done things like show test scores improving, but they, you know, they're testing different cohorts of students, so they're not tracking these kids as they go through the program. And so the data that they have offered up is very suspect.
Let's just give me your sense of what happens now. I mean, project out for us what happens over the next couple of months, both in terms of the bankruptcy process and where you think this leads.
Yeah, I've got two different scenarios that play out in my mind, and one is the very cynical one, and that is that, you know, for all of the positive rhetoric coming from the bankruptcy judge and from Kevin Orr and others about, you know, making Detroit vibrant again and, you know, and being able to provide services to its 700,000 citizens, residents, that what this will end up being is essentially a looting by the banks, that the banks will walk away taking a much, much softer hit on this. And that the groups that have the least amount of political power, for example, the retirees, will take the brunt of the hit. In the process, they'll probably privatize a lot of the assets, like the city water and sewage department, and other city assets. And I think that what will, you know, if my cynical view of the future happens, what will happen is that they will basically make it so untenable to live in Detroit that they'll gentrify it to the point where it becomes, an empty city where investors can now come in for pennies on the dollar and sort of rebuild it in their own image. And that's sort of the cynical view, and I really don't want to believe that's true, but there's a lot of evidence that that's exactly what's happening. And, you know, it's frustrating because there are a lot of entrepreneurs in Detroit. The 700,000 people that are still there, those people are survivors. You know, they're not there because, you know, other reason. They're there because they love Detroit, and that's their home, and they want to make it better again. And a lot of the development that's going on is coming in from outside groups that stand to make a profit. For example, they're planting a major forest in some of the empty areas in Detroit, the Hance Group is. And I can guarantee in about 20 or 30 years, that forest will become a nice, wealthy, posh subdivision full of, you know, mansions because they're literally planting the seeds today for that. My less cynical view of the future is that because of all of the light that's being shined on it, that they're not going to be allowed to do that, and that, you know, people are going to say, hey, you can't just let the banks come in and, you know, basically, you know, strip this carcass of its meat, but you have to invest in Michigan's biggest city, and you have to, you know, do the hard work of rebuilding a city that has fallen on hard times because of economic and other, you know, happenstances outside of its control. And that, you know, people will really wake up and realize that the entire state of Michigan and even the region depends on a vibrant Detroit, and that we have to work together to make that happen. And that's really what my hope is. There are a lot of groups that are working toward that, and there's a lot of, you know, light being shined on this. So I hope that in the long term that bright sunlight will prevent a lot of the more egregious stuff from going forward.
Give me your sense, and I ask this both because I'm curious and for my own pragmatic reasons, because I head back to the area where you're specifically living in for the holidays. My in-laws live all around Ann Arbor and Ypsilanti. Ooh. And but give me the perspective that you sense that the rest of the state has in terms of Detroit, because I know part of the, part of this story definitely has to be about a racial divide. There's always a certain amount of suspicion, not always, but I mean, certainly in many states, there's a suspicion between the surrounding state and the biggest city, and I think, you know, a certain amount of racism has is definitely part of this story. But give me your sense of what the rest of the state is reacting to what's going on in Detroit.
My cynical side tends to come out in an answer to a question like this. And that, you know, first of all, you have to look at the metropolitan Detroit area, the sort of general southeast part of the state. The population of that part of the state has not changed that much in the last 20 years. What's happened is that it's hollowed out. It's, you know, the city of Detroit has been evacuated, but there's a great deal of population density around it in the suburbs. And that's true of places like Flint as well and Pontiac, is that, you know, regionally speaking, the population is pretty stable, but there's been a lot of flight out of the major, you know, out of the core urban areas. And I do think that people that are outside of where most of the hardship is happening don't really want to deal with it. And they don't, you know, they don't want it to affect their lives in any way. And so they tend to look the other way. And your comment about, you know, there being a racial aspect to this, you know, there's no question that is a component of it. Detroit is something like 87% African American. So, you know, it's very easy for people that are looking for a simple, glib explanation for this to just write it off as, you know, these people can't, you know, manage themselves and we need to do it for them and take this sort of patriarchal, you know, top-down approach. If you were to travel to the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, I think that they have even less of a view that's positive about Detroit, because it really doesn't affect them, even though they're part of the state. So I think when it starts to hit things like the Detroit Institute of Arts, and, you know, the kinds of things happen that, you know, affect their ability as a municipality, for example, to borrow money because, you know, of some of the stuff that's going in Detroit, that does wake people up a little bit. Mm. But I do fear that, you know, once you get outside the city limits, that people tend to see it in a, you know, they just want a quick answer to it. And to them, a quick answer is, hey, just send in some experts. These people don't know what they're doing. You know, they're just a bunch of corrupt people that don't know what they're doing. And unfortunately, it's just not the case. And it's a far more complicated and complex crisis than that would say.
Chris Savage, proprietor of CollectaBlog, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate you coming on. We'll, of course, link to your site at majority.fm.
Appreciate it. Thanks, Sam.
All right, folks. We're going to take a break. Head into the fun half, wherein we will talk about the Pope making Jesus cry, and of course, the longstanding relationship with the KGB. We will touch on the platinum coin. Some interesting stuff on the minimum wage front. We'll get to these third way attacks on Democrats, on populist Democrats, I should say. An interesting report from Li Fong about just who is funding the third way. I mean, none of this is really terribly shocking. But it is worth talking about. Of course, the war on Christmas continues. And folks, you know, to field an army like we have fielded here at the Majority Report to wage war on Christmas in the way that we are constantly waging war. We need to create supply lines. We need to draft, and sometimes we forcibly recruit people for the war on Christmas, people who otherwise thought that they liked Christmas. But it takes a lot of resources.
Taking away the magic of Christmas isn't a fly-by-night operation.
No, this is something you have to work at for an extended period of time. All right? I mean, you can't just immediately show up one day and just say, you know, we're gonna ruin the Christmas spirit. You need to... This is a long process. This is our moment to shine, of course, the month of December. When we went out to buy that chainsaw and those axes to go and try and chop down the tree in Rockefeller Center, right. You don't get those for free. They don't give them away to you at Sears. You can't go get a Husky at Sears for free. You got to go pay for it. And
bailout money for ripping down people's wreaths.
That's
you know?
Right.
Like, there's a lot of stuff that goes on here that maybe isn't at the forefront, but it's important.
All those sound machines that we got to buy when we follow those Christmas carolers around as they try and sing. We try and sort of like squeeze out their sound by like sounds of waves or maybe like rainfall. These things that you can't these aren't free.
The Muslim so, call to prayer.
That's right.
That's what we do.
That's right. The attempts to build Muslim Brotherhood community centers in Rockefeller Center.
The Hezbollah rec room.
That's right.
There's a lot of money that this stuff takes.
And so if you have the financial means, I know that people are very squeezed at this time of year, but if you have the financial means to support this program, please, we really do need your support, not just for the war on Christmas, although that's primarily where most of the funds go to.
A Majority Report membership makes a great holiday gift.
Oh, that's right. A great holiday gift. You know,
a way of saying happy holidays.
Right. Or a good late Hanukkah gift.
Or Kwanzaa, concurrent Kwanzaa gift.
Right. Or a winter solstice gift. Any of the number of holidays that take place during the month of December. If you do want to give a gift, right now we haven't quite set up a system to do that. It's only been 3 years. But send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com, and we will walk you through it. It's not terribly complicated. But if you do have the means to support this program this time of year, we have a lot of people who end up having to make a deal with us or stop their paid membership. We never turn anybody away for money if they want access to the second half of the show. But if you are someone who is fortunate enough to have the cash, you're spending a lot of money on your cable bill or whatever, some subscription to something that you don't even like anymore, but you listen to this program on a regular basis, please support the Majority Report today. You can go to majority.fm, sign up to become a member. It costs 33 cents a day. If you think the show is, if you enjoy it, you think it's important, please support it. You can also support this program by buying your Amazon crap through our Amazon link. You can just go to majorityreportkickback.com, majorityreportkickback.com, because we get a kickback every time you buy something through that link. You just click it, bookmark it, buy all your Amazon crap there. You won't know a difference, but we will have a bounce in our step. Also, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. You want to be a part of this program today? 646-257-3920. We welcome all libertarians. Call in. Tell us the latest Michigas that you're talking about. You can also IM me at any of our... Tomorrow, maybe we should have... bring our libertarian friend from Hawaii back on the program for the second half. What do you think? Matt DiGeronimo?
I would be very down with that.
Yeah. I think we've given him some time to lick his wounds, to come up with an argument for something. Anything, really. I mean...
He's got data.
Or
data.
We'll see. I can't remember. Does he say data? I say data.
He
says data.
He must say data.
Yeah. All right.
I can tell you exactly how that call will start, though.
I know. I'm a good-looking guy.
I can't hear you too well. Maybe it's the line.
That's right. All right, folks. See you in the better half.